Lecture 46, The Restoration of Order.
Hello, and welcome to our 46th lecture in the series on the history of ancient Rome. What I want to do today is cover the remarkable period that stretches from AD 270 up to that of 306 or so, the early part of the 4th century, which sees the restoration of the Roman state to order. In fact, under the Emperor Diocletian, as we'll see, it basically sees the Roman Empire restored and reinvented on an entirely new footing. Before we embarked on our thematic survey of the salient characteristics of Roman society and culture, we had seen how the empire in the course of the 3rd century, following the collapse of the Severan dynasty in AD 235, had itself all but collapsed and ceased to exist. By about AD 270, certainly during the reign of Gallienus, the empire had split into three separate states. In the west was the so-called Empire of the Gallic Provinces, the Imperium Galliarum, with its own emperors, its own senate, its own army. In the east was the power of Palmyra, a Syrian oasis town and city of considerable wealth and prominence, which in the course of the 260s under its king Odenathus and his wife Zenobia had gradually extended its influence and control over most of the eastern half of the Roman Empire, especially the rich provinces of Egypt and Syria, and was even making inroads into Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. The Roman Empire proper, then, was reduced to a mere trunk comprising Italy, the Balkan region, and Africa. It seemed as if the empire was fragmenting. And yet, in the period to be surveyed today, under vigorous and aggressive emperors, and also a particularly gifted consolidator and administrator, order was restored, as was unity. The barbarian invasions of the 3rd century continued to pose a problem, and the first signs of a turnaround occurred, in fact, in this sphere. Gallienus had made some inroads in throwing back the massive Gothic invasion of the eastern half of the empire in the late 260s, before he was, as we've seen, murdered by his own troops. And his work was continued by his successor, Claudius II, called Gothicus, conqueror of the Goths. In 268 and 269, Claudius succeeded in flinging the marauding Goths out of the Roman Empire and back across the Danube River. He was an energetic man, an army officer, and from the area of the empire called Illyria, basically modern-day former Yugoslavia, that area of the world, Albania and Yugoslavia on the coast of the Adriatic. That's the area of ancient Illyria. In fact, it was from this part of the empire that all these energetic and militarily gifted emperors were to come from. Claudian, however, fell ill of the plague and died after only 2 years in office, and it seemed as if things might go back to unpleasantness. But his successor, Aurelian, was even more energetic and more aggressive. Aurelian, in the space of merely 5 years, reunified the empire into a single entity. He also was an Illyrian, a officer in Claudius' army, and he was acclaimed by the troops upon Claudius' death. He appears, by all accounts, to have been a dynamo, a virtual, veritable whirlwind of action. His nickname was Manu ad Ferrum, which means hand on hilt, clearly indicating his military nature as well as his lust for action. He was a professional soldier, and he got to work straight away. In AD 271, he visited Rome for the first time and initiated there the building, for the first time since the 4th century BC, of a new set of walls for the city. There could be no better expression of the uncertainty of the times than that Rome itself was deemed to require a new set of fortifications. It's a massive circuit of walls, the Aurelianic Circuit, covering some 12 miles in circumference. It has 18 major gates and about as many postern gates, and no less than 381 towers along its length, projecting from the walls themselves. Still a major monument of ancient Rome to any modern visitors. The large sections of the Aurelianic Wall are preserved virtually intact. Having visited Rome and initiated the construction of a new set of walls for the city, such a powerful symbol of the age, Aurelian turned his attention first to the Palmyrian secessionist state. This, after all, was the most foreign of the powers. The Empire of the Gauls and of the Gallic provinces, as it's sometimes called, was at least distinctly Roman in character, but Palmyra had a very Eastern and foreign feel to it, and so its occupation and control of the Eastern provinces had to be dealt with first. Campaigning and defeating Palmyrian forces in Asia Minor and sending a lieutenant, Probus, to recapture Egypt, Aurelian, in typical fashion, made a beeline straight for Palmyra itself. This was an oasis town located in the middle of open desert. And Aurelian's army, in a remarkable act, marched some 80 miles across the open desert, carrying all their supplies and the wood necessary to prosecute a siege, and set up camp outside Palmyra. Such was the vigor and aggressiveness of the action that we hear the Queen Zenobia quickly despaired of being able to withstand. And if we believe our sources, which are very, very scrappy for this period, she fled the city, trying to seek asylum among the Persians across the Euphrates River. But she was captured on the banks of the river, taken before Aurelian. If we believe her stories again, she begged and grovelled, blamed everything on her advisers, but was spared and sent to Rome, where she eventually walked in the triumph of Aurelian in AD 274 in golden chains, if we believe the story. After that, she was retired, married to a senator, and lived out her days to a grand old age as a respectable woman in Italy. However, in control now of Palmyra, Aurelian, in a tremendous act of decency, spared the place. This is another feature of Aurelian. He maintains his troops in good discipline. In the course of the real chaos of the 3rd century, Roman troops had taken great pleasure in sacking any cities that they came across, cities either belonging to their opponents in civil wars or cities that had fallen to barbarians. Well, Aurelian put a stop to that and maintained discipline throughout his campaigns in Asia Minor, and also even when he captured Palmyra, his troops were not allowed to sack the city. He then turned his attention west, but as he was moving westward when he was in Syria, he heard that Palmyra had revolted against his rule and in anger turned around, went back and destroyed the place. It's never recovered. It was reduced to the status of a village, although the remains of the ancient city still stand as a remarkable site in modern-day Syria and well worth a visit. However, by 273, Aurelian had destroyed the Palmyrian state and reintegrated the eastern provinces of the empire. For this achievement, his coins hail him as Restitutor Orientis, the restorer of the east. Aurelian, having celebrated his triumph in 274 in Rome, then turned his attention to the empire of the Gallic provinces. Invading the Imperium Galliarum, which was now under its fourth emperor, a man called Tetricus, he fought a battle against his opponent on the Marne River in 274, and once again, Aurelian emerged victorious. The empire of the Gallic provinces ceased to exist, and the western half of the Roman Empire also came back under the authority of the central Roman emperor. So between 272, really, and 274, in the space of 3 years of campaigning, Aurelian had restored the integrity of the Roman state, a remarkable achievement in and of itself. His coins now hail him as Restitutor Orbis, the restorer of the world. Unfortunately for Aurelian, he lived in uncertain times and difficult times. The manner of his death was ludicrous, if it wasn't so tragic. He was a man apparently prone to losing his temper, had rather a short fuse, and he unleashed his anger on one occasion on one of his secretaries. The secretary, we hear, was fearful for his life, and so he forged a death list in the handwriting of the emperor of several major and important officers under his command. The secretary then showed this forged death list to the officers in question, who out of fear attacked and murdered Aurelian as he was getting off his horse to relieve himself on the march. That was the end of the man who was the restorer of the world. Silly indeed. This was in 275. The army was disgusted once the forgery had been revealed. The army was disgusted at its own actions. They had lost the most energetic emperor since Trajan. And as a result, it seems, power was allowed to pass to an aged senator named Tacitus, who ruled only for 6 months and whose brief reign is not really of any note. It was instead one of Aurelian's officers, Probus, who had been in command of Egypt, who emerged in 276 as the next energetic emperor. To cut a long story short, he repelled many barbarian invasions and maintained the integrity of the empire that Aurelian had re-established. But he was a strict disciplinarian, and he would have, during peacetime, when his army was not on command, he would set them to work in a variety of civic projects. Apparently they'd had enough when he ordered them to drain a marsh, mutinied, and killed him in 282. It seemed as if the empire would descend into civil war. In fact, there was a civil war following Probus's death, but it was short-lived, and out of the dust emerged yet another Illyrian army commander from the humblest of births, a man called Diocletian, who came to power in 284 by defeating his opponents. In Diocletian, the Roman Empire found a man of tremendous energy and administrative capabilities. Diocletian's role was that of a consolidator. He built upon the military achievements of Aurelian and Probus and re-established the Roman Empire on a whole new footing, giving it a new lease on life that was to last 200 years. So far from collapsing in the 3rd century, in the space now of just over 14 years, the empire has been restored to unity and has at its helm a tremendously able administrator who was to give it a whole new shape. The reforms introduced by Diocletian, there are many, and I'm just going to survey some of the most important ones. It would be impossible to treat them in any great detail in a format such as this. But suffice it to say that the type of empire that Diocletian created was much more openly autocratic and despotic than the one which Augustus had created. For this reason, the empire of Diocletian is sometimes called the Dominate, derived from the word dominus, meaning master. The phrase used to describe an owner of a slave, for instance, would be dominus. So this is to be distinguished from the Principate, which is the system of government that Augustus had introduced, derived from the notion of the princeps, the leading citizen, where the emperor was much less openly autocratic. Under Diocletian's system, under the Dominate, the emperor was, in fact, an open despot, a militarily supported despot. Court ritual, for instance, under Diocletian was elaborated enormously. The emperor would sit on raised daises in huge halls, dressed all in purple, surrounded by guards in resplendent uniforms and a host of advisers. To be brought into his presence was a major affair. It's not quite the same approachable emperor as we've seen, say, under Hadrian, having his toga tugged by an old woman asking him to hear her petition. This is not the environment of the Dominate. Rather, the emperor has become the font of all authority and power, and is displayed as such. Diocletian also was legitimated in his rule by an appeal to divine sponsorship, particularly the two gods Jupiter, the national god of the Romans, and Hercules. Hercules, in the course of the 2nd and 3rd century, had emerged as something of an imperial deity. The German phrase used to describe Hercules as Kaisergott. He's the imperial god, the god of the Kaisers, of the Caesars. And this was now institutionalized and formalized under Diocletian. The emperor, Diocletian, was a representative of Jupiter and Hercules on earth. They were his protectors. He was there to maintain order and see to it that the empire prospered. As a result of this, it's not hard to appreciate then why Christians came to be persecuted. They would not recognize that divine sponsorship. They would not sacrifice to Jupiter or to Hercules or to the spirit of the emperor himself. And so Diocletian instituted the great persecutions beginning in 299, which ran until 311. The persecutions escalated in ferocity. It was genuinely an attempt to stamp out, punish Christianity for not taking part in the new religious and political order of the state. But it was prosecuted unevenly across the vast empire. It seems that the most aggressive prosecutor was a subordinate of Diocletian's, a man called Galerius, who comes down to us as having a genuine vitriolic hatred of Christians. And in his portion of the empire especially, Christians suffered terribly. But in other parts of the empire, the rulers on the spot were less than enthusiastic about the whole endeavor. And so the great persecution as well, despite its principled assault on Christianity, was not even really as vicious and widespread as many might believe. Diocletian, by a series of reforms, also established the economy and the administration of the empire on what was pretty much a permanent war footing. For instance, he divided the old provinces into much smaller units. He almost doubled the number of provinces, raising the number from 50 to about 100. and then put those provinces under very close administration. The purpose of this was to increase centralized control over taxation so that no one could escape from the tax net. Taxes themselves were vastly increased. We hear in later years of taxes in the region of one-third or even one-half of the produce of a farm having to be handed over to the state. So the taxes themselves and the administrative units designed to supervise taxation were increased. Above the provinces, or to put it better, between the provinces and the emperor, Diocletian introduced yet another level of administration to supervise the running of these smaller province units. He grouped the provinces into units, 13 units called dioceses, which were sort of province groups, each with their own sort of super governor, a man called vicarius, vicar. It's easy to see, of course, how all these terms have crept into the Christian administration since the Christians adopted these terms in organizing their churches. These vicars were answerable in turn to other subordinate officials, praetorian prefects, and the praetorian prefects were then answerable to the emperor. So the whole centralization of the state is much more profound than it had been under the principate. Another major difference between the principate and the dominate. The dominant is a much more centralized state. The role of the cities in looking after their own affairs has declined considerably now, and this is a place that's much more heavily taxed, much more heavily monitored. Why all this taxation? Why these administrative reforms? Well, the purpose was to support the army. The army was now reformed. It was practically doubled in numbers, perhaps as many as 600,000 men now under arms, and it was reformed to become an effective fighting force against the continual threat of barbarian incursions. The barbarian pressures on the frontiers of the empire increased and were sustained throughout the 3rd and 4th centuries. In fact, they got even worse in the 4th and 5th centuries. Diocletian divided the army into two halves. The former infantry wing of the army was greatly reduced and set on the frontiers as border guards. The technical term was they were limitanei. Bordermen, literally men set on the borders. Behind them, in the hinterland of the empire, he established cavalry-based strike forces, following along the reforms of Gallienus. Diocletian greatly increased the role of the cavalry in the Roman armament. This wing of the army was called the comitatenses, the companions of the emperor. They were strike forces, the purpose of which was to repel any barbarian invasions that got past the borders. It was strategically a sound decision, but it did make the army a lot bigger and a lot more expensive. After all, in addition to soldiers, a cavalry army has to provide food and provisions for horses as well. And so the expense of maintaining this greatly expanded army was the chief motivation for the administrative reforms and the increased taxation of Diocletian's reordering of the empire. But his most revolutionary reforms were definitely in the region of the upper echelons of the administration, and specifically in dealing with the succession problem. Diocletian realized that the succession problem had been a massive cause of the upheavals of the 3rd century AD, emperors constantly being challenged by usurpers, and he was the first emperor to think about and try to establish some form of a constitutional system for the passing of power from one emperor to the next. This reform of his, the system of his, is termed the Tetrarchy, for reasons that we'll see in a minute. Diocletian realized and learned from the successes and existence of the regional powers of the Empire of the Gallic Provinces in the west and Palmyra in the east, and realized that the empire was too big and the challenges facing the emperor of the late 3rd century too many for one man to handle alone. So he appointed one of his generals, Maximian, to be a co-emperor with himself. He gave him the title Augustus, along with himself. This was the title for the emperor, Augustus. So Diocletian and Maximian were both Augusti in the plural. Diocletian's concern was predominantly with the eastern half of the empire, and Maximian was given as his chief concern the maintenance of order and security in the western half of the empire. This system worked so effectively in repelling barbarian incursions that by about AD 290 or so, Diocletian took it a step further. He appointed below Maximian and himself two further junior emperors whom he called Caesars. So each of the Augusti had below them two junior emperors called Caesars. These are the four princes that make up the rule of the Tetrarchs. That's what Tetrarchy means, the rule of the four princes. The Caesars were to be able army officers, not related by blood to the Augusti above them. They were to be nominated by the Augusti and bound to the Augusti by adoption and marital ties. But the choice of a subordinate emperor of a Caesar was to be made on the basis of ability. As a result, then, the Tetrarchy was the first attempt on the part of a Roman emperor to ensure a smooth succession from one emperor to the next. Because the idea was that when the Augusti had finished their reigns, their respective Caesars would rise up and become themselves Augusti, and would then appoint able army officers below them as replacements. So you'd have two new Caesars below them, and so on and so forth, so that the system was a self-sustaining system of succession. I must stress that the Tetrarchs had, each of them had control over specific parts of the empire, but the empire was not divided officially between them. In the Tetrarchic ideology, the Tetrarchy was a single administration of a single unit, the empire as a whole. All proclamations from one Tetrarch were signed and presented as being proclamations from all four. Military triumphs by one Tetrarch were celebrated by all four. And there's a wonderful statue in the St. Mark's Square in Venice, an ancient antique statue that shows the Tetrarchs. It perfectly captures the ideology of the Tetrarchs. The four men, very dour-looking guys. I mean, these are not happy people. They're living in tough times, just scowling. All of them with their hands on their swords, on the hilts of their swords, ready for action, and all embracing each other, their arms all around each other, sort of in a group hug. It's a wonderful statue, these scowling chaps with hands on the hilts, arms around each other, presenting a unified face to the world, ready for action, and very much a administrative and political unity. That, at least, was the ideology. So the individual Tetrarchs then established capitals for themselves, new capitals that began to see the decline of Rome as the genuine administrative centre of the empire. It was the symbolic focus of the empire, of course, but strategic demands required that the Tetrarchs be positioned close to the frontiers, where the threat of barbarian invasion was greatest. And so new cities, Trier, for instance, was to control the lower Rhine. That's where the Caesar of the West tended to have his seat. The Augustus of the West had his seat in Milan, in North Italy, to control the upper Rhine and Danube. Then Sirmium in the Balkan regions was to control the lower Danube, and that was occupied by the Caesar of the East. And Diocletian, Augustus of the East, took up residence in Turkey, in the city of Nicomedia, to supervise the eastern frontier. But I stress again, despite these new imperial capitals, we're not dealing with a division of the empire into four separate entities. Diocletian's empire, then, was, in a phrase, an empire under siege. He did give it a new lease on life. His system lasted for the best part of 200 years, but it was a dark and gloomy sort of place. The level of centralized control over local affairs was greatly increased. Levels of taxation from Diocletian onwards simply rose and rose and rose, all in the service of the army. The rulers themselves were distant, aloof, divinely mandated despots. This is a very different place indeed from the empire of Hadrian and Augustus. Despite the ingenuity of the Tetrarchic system, it had a fatal flaw. It failed to take into account the power of family loyalties in determining the behaviours of upper-class Romans. In the Tetrarchic system of succession, the Caesars, the sub-emperors, were to be appointed on the basis of ability and merit. They were not necessarily to be relatives of the ruling emperors, of the ruling Augusti. Nevertheless, Diocletian did not see this flaw, and confident, utterly confident of the virtues of his system, he retired, the first emperor ever to voluntarily abdicate his power in AD 305. He claimed that the burdens of office were too great, he was too old, and he retired, however, not to a townhouse in Rome, but to a fortress in the city, the modern-day city of Split in Croatia. In fact, Diocletian's palace at Split is still visible today, forms the core of the old town of Split in Croatia. There he devoted himself, we hear, to raising cabbages. When he retired in 305, he forced his co-emperor, his co-Augustus Maximian, also to retire so as to allow the Tetrarchy to work. As a result, the two Caesars, Galerius in the east and Constantius in the west, now became Augusti, and just as the Tetrarch system should work, they appointed junior officers, junior Caesars below them, junior emperors called Caesars below them. But the problems began almost immediately. Maximian chafed at the fact that he had been forced to retire when Diocletian had made that choice voluntarily. More than that, Maximian had a son, Maxentius, who felt that he'd been cheated out of his due by the Tetrarchic system. As a result, in AD 306, Maxentius, with the backing of his father, seized Rome and declared himself Augustus. Cracks were appearing almost immediately in the ideal of the Tetrarchy. Worse was to come. In Britain, the now Augustus of the West, Constantius, had been campaigning against the Picts north of Hadrian's Wall. But he died in York in AD 306. Almost immediately, Constantius' army declared his natural son, Constantine, Augustus. So in AD 306, there were no less than four men wandering around the empire claiming to be Augustus, the chief emperor of the state. There were the two legitimate former Caesars who had taken over when Maximian and Diocletian had retired, and there were also two usurpers, Maxentius, who now occupied Rome, and Constantine, gathering his forces in Britain and the West. Thus revealed at its very first outing was the flaw and the failure of the Tetrarchy. It was never tried again. The system collapsed within a few years. Its flaw was to ignore or require of Roman aristocrats that they ignore family loyalties, and that was not something that the aristocrats or the soldiers that they commanded were willing to do. What we'll examine in the next lecture, very briefly, is the late imperial period, that stretches, covers the reign of Constantine and takes us up to the so-called fall of the Western Empire in 476. As I said at the start of this course, we will not be devoting as much time to the later imperial period as we have been doing to the classical period of Roman history. That's because the later imperial period is so much more complex and so different in many ways from the nature of the empire in the classical period. Really, the subject of late antiquity, the period from the 4th, 5th and 6th centuries onwards, and the Byzantine period are subjects for a separate course. But nonetheless, for the sake of completeness, we will treat them, albeit perfunctorily, and next time we'll examine the reign of Constantine, who made some serious changes and significant changes in the way the Roman Empire was organized.